Welcome to Pemba On Demand. I'm Norm Chapin, your host. I am very excited to welcome you to our podcast. Pemba On Demand is produced for physicians interested in professional development. We will be discussing a wide range of topics on the podcast. I will be interviewing physician leaders from the U.S. and from other countries who have graduated from the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee. These physicians will be sharing stories of professional and personal growth, overcoming challenges in their organizations, and discussing key leadership skills they have learned from the MBA program and ongoing professional development. Dr. Camilo Gomez will be our guest today. If you have any questions or comments for Dr. Gomez, please write them in the guest chat on the YouTube site, and we'll be taking time to answer questions at the end of the show. Camilo is a fellow Pemba alumnus, graduated from the Pemba program back in 2006. He's also a vascular and interventional neurologist and currently practices at the University of Missouri Medical Center. Camilo, welcome to the Pemba On Demand live stream.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you having me and I'm flattered that you asked me to be here.
Well, we're excited to have you on the show today. I'm looking forward to learning about your project and the innovations that you have created at the University of Missouri Medical Center. As I was preparing for this talk, I got really excited about learning about how you approached it. So I appreciate you taking the time to come on the show.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I thought maybe before we dove into your project, not sure which is correct, I wanted to talk with you a little bit about your professional career and maybe have you share some of your thoughts regarding your MBA. I know you graduated from Pemba a few years before me in 2006, but would you mind sharing a little bit with the audience about your experience with Pemba at the University of Tennessee and maybe share with us a little bit about your motivation for getting an advanced degree like the MBA?
Absolutely. I think that my decision to join the Pemba program and completing it is probably one of the best decisions that I have made in my career. I highly recommend it for anybody, particularly in mid-career, and anyone who is going to be involved in managerial leadership positions. I certainly think that every departmental chair in any university in the United States should have gone through a program like this. We can talk a little bit about the specifics. Now, what happened to me is that in 2003, I decided to leave my post as stroke center director at the University of Alabama, Birmingham. And for a variety of personal reasons, I decided that I needed to stay in the city of Birmingham. So I essentially moved into creating a private practice group at the time was what we sort of call privademia, if you will, which was a hybrid for, yes, we do private practice, but we were involved in things. The difference being that we substituted the bureaucracy inherent to university systems for our own infrastructure. And as such, I moved into the business world to some degree. In order to create that, I wrote a business plan. Even before I went to Pemba, I wrote a business plan out of nowhere, got a loan from the bank and move on. But it became quickly apparent as CEO of this corporation that I needed to be able to, at the very least, speak the language to be able to communicate, to negotiate successfully, to benefit and have my people benefit from our participation in a variety of programs. And so at the time being, again, mid-career, I said, you know, I think getting a master's in business administration is probably the next best step. That decision was solidified by a happenstance meeting with an old friend of mine, a neurosurgeon of trade, that I happened to be in Dallas for a national meeting, and we ended up having dinner together. And I said, you know what, I'm thinking of Actually, he said to me, I'm thinking of going to business school. And I said, well, I just matriculated at the University of Tennessee. And he said, are you kidding me? I said, no. And said, so he actually matriculated the next week and became one of my classmates in 2006. So we actually, as friends of 20, 30 years, went through the program together, graduated through the program together. And it was a phenomenal experience for us, sort of as a second high school, so to speak, you know, misbehaving and so on. But the program, when I started looking into which program is available to a physician, by all metrics, the PEMBA program comes across head and shoulders above everybody else's in terms of duration, intensity, focus, the dimensions. It is so refreshing that on one hand, you learn the same business principles that any business program may have. But on the other hand, every example or many of the examples or the bulk of the examples have to do with medical care. And therefore, they're immediately applicable to what you're doing. The projects that you have to do with your own practice and so on and so forth. And the friendships and comradeship that you make with the other classmates, they essentially last forever. And I'm still a member of the Alumni Council. And I enjoy communicating quite a bit, and I've enjoyed very much actually communicating with you guys. So when we finish this project we're going to talk about today, it seemed to me fitting that I let you know about it because there may be of interest to any other people. I think that there's strength in numbers in terms of growing the disciplines, if you will, of applying good business practices to medical care.
So at the time that you began or matriculated into PEMBA, were you still in private practice or had you gone back into another healthcare organizational role?
No, I was still in private practice. And as a private practitioner, one of the things that you quickly realize is because you don't control or own the hospital, which is a separate business entity, you are in constant flux with a relationship which moves from the symbiotic to the antagonistic very quickly with hospital administration. The hospital administrators have their own priorities, they have their own metrics, and they have their own people. And if you are not facile on your feet, you can get gobbled up very quickly. I think that I think that's an important point of view to have. I moved back to the academic world in 2016, 10 years later, actually. Mm. And I did so because, frankly, there comes a point in private practice where I got bored, essentially. I just intellectually, I got bored. And I got to a point where I was looking at the end game of my career. And I said, okay, well, let me finish doing what I like to do, which is educate and do research and then practice at a high end. And then I started shedding a lot of my titles, so to speak, administrative titles, which I don't really want or need more titles. I've had enough of those. But the curiosity and the passion for excellence in care and quality remain there. And I think that this is where PEMBA gave me an edge in terms of allowing me to focus on that, and as you'll see, some of the things that we've been doing, and the reasons why we're doing them.
So you entered into PEMBA when you were in private practice, and it sounds like you were really looking for business knowledge to help you run a business. Tell me how that learning and knowledge translated over when you went back into an academic position.
Oh, it was priceless, absolutely priceless. The moment you go back with your PEMBA knowledge and you sit up in a meeting with the hospital administration, if you're a private practitioner and you open your mouth and ask certain questions, they look at each other like, uh-oh, we cannot put a veil over this guy's eyes anymore. And they have to be on their toes, to be quite honest with you, even in the university on a daily basis. And I think that when we were planning this, we had a conversation. a lot of the people, for example, not too long ago, I got a communication from our so-called supply chain about trying to change the coils that we use for aneurysms. And they sent this spreadsheet that was essentially incorrect. And both in scope as well as focus. So I sent it back via email with my corrections and said, by the way, your spreadsheet was incorrect and you're not looking at this correctly because you want us to use the cheaper coils and you're counting cost per coil. But if the better coils, which are more expensive, end up per case using less number of coils, you've got to look at the cost per case, not the cost per coil. Within a couple of emails, they stopped sending any more emails. They stopped asking. So, you know, it's knowledge is power, and the mm-hmm. ability to ask the right questions and negotiate from a position of intellectual strength and, you know, having the data to prove it, I think it's important. When I was in private practice, for example, one of the things that happened to us is that I got this dashboard one time about, you know, the quality of care. You know, these patients you're admitting with stroke your length of stay is too long. It's longer than the average in the nation. So I took the data, rearranged the analysis, and said, look carefully at my analysis. Look how the patients who are admitted on Friday in my service have a longer length of stay statistically than the ones that are admitting on Monday, which means that the testing that we need to do for them is not being done on the weekends. So until you start running a 7-day hospital, I don't want to hear from you. Because you can't blame me for a length of stay because you don't provide the services that we need on the weekends. Mm-hmm. That ended that conversation also. So it's about really looking at information from the perspective of the person who is taking fire with boots on the ground as opposed to somebody sitting in an office in front of spreadsheets without knowledge of what is required to take care of these patients.
Right. Well, those are great stories, and I appreciate you sharing those with us. I wonder if you could share one last thought with us before we move on to your presentation. What is your favorite memory of Pemba? And just for people in the audience who might not be aware, at Pemba we have four RPs, residence periods, where we come onto campus, and every Saturday we would do virtual learning when we weren't on campus. But maybe share a little bit about your favorite memory. It sounds like you had opportunities because you knew someone to maybe your behavior wasn't always as professional as it might be when you were in the hospital.
Well, we were professional mischievous, but that's for sure. We didn't get paid for our mischiefs, but we could have actually collected. But it was, again, that was fun because having somebody that you've known and be friends with for a number of years helps. And I frankly, I would encourage anyone who's considering joining Pemba, if you have a friend or a colleague that you know and you get along well, bring them along. I mean, it makes a phenomenal difference. But as far as what I enjoyed about Pemba, I'm telling you, the list is long and distinguished. I particularly enjoyed not that I'm terribly competitive, you know, I'm not going to admit to all of that, but we enjoyed the Masters of the Universe competition, I mean, immensely. This buddy of mine, my neurosurgery friend, happens to have a PhD in mathematics. So we actually, you know, reverse engineer the formulas and ended up winning. It's just we had everybody down because we knew exactly what everybody was doing. And we enjoyed it immensely. That was one of the most fun we've had in a long time, building a company that made computers and market computers. Mm-hmm. But there were many, many things. The speakers, the teachers are first class. I couldn't begin to name them because I'm going to leave somebody out. But they're amazing people. They treat you very nicely. They have your best interests at heart. And you get to a point where you're looking forward to the next residency period. So it was really a great experience all around. I highly recommend it.
Well, thank you for sharing those thoughts and memories. I just listening to you talk, I thought about some of the enjoyable times I had, and the bringing back the game where you're trying to build a company. I can't say that we won. We remained in first place until the very last RP, and then someone came from behind to smoke us. And so I don't know if they were using some of the techniques that you and your friend developed. Well, I'm excited to move on now, and let's talk a little bit about the efforts that you've had underway at the University of Missouri to optimize endovascular interventions. I know that you've published a paper about this, and I'm looking forward to watching your presentation, so we'll move right into that. And if you just let me know when to advance the slides, I will take care of that for us.
Absolutely. So this is the title of the presentation today. If you can move to the next slide. I wanted to tell the audience a little bit about our Comprehensive Stroke Center, which is in the city of Columbia, Missouri, which is almost exactly halfway between St. Louis and Kansas City. We cover 25-plus counties. We really are the tertiary medical center for rural mid-Missouri. We have five of our own ground ambulance bases, and we have four of our own air ambulance bases. As time has it, next slide, please. We, largely speaking, see approximately 1,400 to 1,500, give or take on any year, cold stroke alerts, of which approximately 800 or so end up being confirmed strokes of one type or another. We give thrombolytic intravenous thrombolysis for acute ischemic stroke probably 2 to 3 times per week, take care of those patients. And we do about 90 or so urgent neurointerventions for acute ischemic stroke, which is the subject of our project. In the context of doing somewhere between 700 and 800 neurointerventional procedures, we do about 45 aneurysms a year. And as a result of all of this work, we generate enough data. We are sitting on enough data that, you know, I could quit my job today and spend a lifetime analyzing data. We're looking at actually growing that. But as I'll explain, we do have some challenges, as I'm sure others do. So the object of our discussion today, next slide, is the fact that we were able for the first time to publish our work. And I would like to emphasize the fact that I'm really the spokesperson for a group of people that are named there who do a lot of work and a lot of daily work. And I want you to think about this project as really almost like a proof of concept. It comes about from our stubbornness and our realization that, as I will explain in a few minutes, that the quality metrics that are presently used by the regulatory agencies on stroke centers, in my opinion, are inadequate and incomplete. One of the things that I liked before I went through PEMBA, but got solidified after working with the people at PEMBA about quality, is processes like Lean Six Sigma, both in operations, quality, outcomes, et cetera, et cetera. And I am convinced that we are way behind in the medical sector of our economy on applying these types of strategies for quality projects. And this is really the motivation that I wanted to introduce this. Over the course of time, I got certified as a black belt in Lean Six Sigma. And I wanted to see if we could get something a little bit with better teeth. And I'll walk you through that process a little bit and what motivated this. And this is why we're here today. Next slide. And the first thing that, as I said, that got us to where we are and to show what I think is it should be the first of many of these similar projects and different a system is looking at the existing metrics. And again, just like Eli Goldratt said, you know, when the measurements are not clearly defined, it doesn't really give you the information that you think it needs. If you go to the next slide, let me give you an example. So what do we mean by this? Well, These are some of the metrics that we have that are by regulation required to maintain accreditation for any stroke center. If you look at, for example, and I'll show you some of these, metric 29, which is in the middle. Let's look at that for the first time. Timeliness of reperfusions from skin puncture to optimal reperfusion of the brain. Well, the truth of the matter is this is an interesting metric, but you as an operator, you may or may not have complete control. There are some instances, for example, the case that we did last night, the clots came out in pieces in three different attempts. The patient, and it took us probably 45 minutes from start to finish. The case that I did yesterday morning was a case where we had to clear four separate vessels, use separate different devices, an enormous amount of clot burden, and is a case for which control was a little bit out of, it's not the same that it's in the first case because it's a much more complex case, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that. And then the post-treatment reperfusion grade, you know, TICI is the metric that we use, which is thrombolysis in cerebral infarction grades. The optimal is 3 is the maximum, 2B to 3 is what you're desirable, which is what has been shown to have optimal outcomes. But if you look carefully, the post-treatment reperfusion grade is influenced by how you deal with metric 29. So you cannot separate them and consider them without considering the consequences of one upon the other. And then it gets worse than that because then metric 28, which is at the bottom of the screen, is timeliness of reperfusion from the arrival time, the moment the patient gets to the hospital, to the time to reperfusion. Well, as I will show you, that was our beginning of our target for our project because it became pretty clear that this is a very highly complex interval with many components that you cannot influence by just saying, okay, I'm going to shorten the arrival to reperfusion time as a blank metric. So let me walk you through this. Let's go back to metric 29. Next slide. Why is it that we have to be careful with the skin puncture to reperfusion is because in 2024, as we are right now, it is no longer tenable to say thrombectomy, for example, which is a common term, because we have multiple levels of complexity depending upon what vessel is occluded or multiple vessels that are occluded, whether the patient has an underlying pathology that requires treatment, for example, placement of a stent or not. So I think in order for us to start looking at this problem, you got to start comparing apples to apples and oranges to oranges. And a category one intervention, which is a simple thrombectomy like the one we sort of did last evening in the middle of the night, is completely different to a category three thrombectomy that we did yesterday morning that instead of 45 minutes, it took us 3 hours just to finish up. And that has consequences in terms of outcome and so on. And if you're going to look at outcomes, you're going to have to factor which category because otherwise you're not comparing things that are barely comparable. How big of an issue it is? Well, as it turns out, we're beginning to look at some of this stuff and this material for our own accreditation. Next slide. And in the last visit that we had this past February, we showed, next slide, please, just a very preliminary breakdown about a fourth of all of our thrombectomies or urgent intervention are category three. And I think this is an underestimation. We're still beginning to, because we're essentially creating this category grid scale that doesn't exist to try to, and our intent is to publish it to show that in fact, category three is a different standard than category one and therefore needs to be assessed differently. And that I think at some point in time, the performance of an organization will have to be related to the weighted average of what proportion of category one, what proportion of category three do they have. In this context, I think this is in and of itself is a potential project all of its own. But the one that we really wanted to tackle was the door to puncture delays, the arrival to puncture delays. Next slide. And as I said, from our point of view, data rules. And I think that, as has been said before, in God we trust, everybody else brings data. And we collect data for everything. We have spreadsheets upon spreadsheets upon spreadsheets. And the problem, one of the problems that we face is the amount of time required to do the analysis we have. So, in other words, we thought that the metrics as they were being used by the regulatory agencies were essentially not adequate, and we wanted a fresh look. Next slide. And we decided to apply the Lean Six Sigma DMAIC process using the measurements from the existing databases that we created, supplemented by relevant data points on an ad hoc basis, and then produce solid statistical analysis that would allow us to create sensitivity analysis when necessary, look at variances of processes, and then identify within our own workflow opportunities for success, or the so-called low-hanging fruit, if you will, and use that to our advantage in proposed projects. And this is a general slide of what we want to do and we want to continue to do and we were proposing to our organization. So we started, next slide, by looking at how things were at the time we decided to move in this direction. So this is the data that we had. These are the data that we had. And we had the median time, door to puncture, puncture to first pass to reperfusion. But as I said, if you look carefully at puncture to first pass and first pass to reperfusion, first pass being the first contact with the occluding particle, those are very, very procedural dependent. It's sometimes it's within the control of the organization of the operator, and sometimes they're not. For example, given two patients with the same occluded vessel, one of them has occluded iliac arteries, and we have to go from the radial approach. That's going to be a slightly different procedure, if not completely different procedure, than going from the femoral approach. And all of those things need to be taken into account. But based upon the data of what we had at the present time, next, we created the first step in a good Lean Six Sigma project, which is writing the problem statement. And for those of you who are interested in doing this, I suggest that the first step is to generate a problem statement that is as specific as you can make it and tied up to the metrics that you want to measure. In this case, we looked at, in calendar year, the rate of excessive delays in a predefined door to puncture time. And it used to be called door to groin time, but now we're doing a lot of radial urgent arteriotomies. So it's door to puncture time. What by our measurement approximated 20%, when we thought the allowable was 2%, which is tenfold the problem. And if you look at tenfold the cost of delaying the care, somewhere in there, the length of stay is going to be affected, the cost of the entire case is going to be affected, the mortality of the patient is going to be affected, the morbidity of the patient is going to be affected. So it's imperative that this is going to look at a certain way. Now, how do we look at this data? Next slide. Well, our workflow, if you look at it in a cross-functional pattern, this is what it looks like. Essentially, the patient arrives, is qualified for intravenous thrombolysis in the CT scanner. And at that time, if the patient qualifies for intravenous thrombolysis, is administered there at that very moment while additional images have been acquired to qualify for urgent thrombectomy. And if that's the case, we move on. And where you see the arrow, the next step is we created a group activation. So every member of the team, and at that time it did not include the anesthesia people, was activated. And then everybody knew they were supposed to converge at the catheterization laboratory for their procedure. Now, within the context of that workflow, next slide, this is what we had from 2021. It was essentially a not very well controlled process. You can see the variability. You can see that at least one point is outside of the three sigma, three standard deviation line, which makes it immediately qualify for not very well controlled processes. So we said, okay, so the process is not well controlled. What are the possible explanations for this? We started from the general and then moved to the specific. Next slide. One possibility, for example, is that those patients that got intravenous TPA, there's a delay in giving the IV TPA. Well, guess what? We could not prove that. The people who got TPA and the ones that didn't get TPA, there was a little more variance in the ones that didn't get TPA, as a matter of fact. So it was actually counterintuitive that that was the case, but no statistical significance. Then we said to ourselves, well, maybe the people who come after hours have to wait longer. Next slide. Well, we couldn't prove that either. So even the patient, so the process was just as out of control. That's how I viewed it. Out of control during on hours or after hours. It didn't really matter. So we had to look for another explanation. So it occurred to us that to go back to our criticisms of those metrics, next slide, and begin to think that the door to puncture interval really is a composite of multiple subintervals. And we hypothesized, and I think we have been right, that each one of these intervals needs to be addressed or can be and should be addressed in and of itself. And there are going to be some surprising findings about this, but there are some specific things that you can do for each one of these and that they need to be addressed in their own right. So if you look at the tier one subintervals, the major divisions of the door to puncture interval is door to arrival at the angio suite and then angio arrival to the puncture. As we said, we stopped at the puncture because once you puncture the skin and you start the case, that's a whole ball of wax in terms of procedural complexity, and that it's going to require its own analysis. But those two could be looked at, and we did. Next slide. And what we found is that the biggest problem we had was getting the patient to the angiography suite. Once the patient was arriving to the angiography suite, we did much better. Clearly, the variance, statistically significant, was that. And then we started looking at the other tiers, a more and more granular look at the subintervals. Next slide. And then we found out that what was, in a Pareto analysis, the biggest component of that interval? Well, it was from the group activation to the arrival at the angio suite. And we found out that there were a whole bunch of delays there. And then there were delays from the CT being completed to the group activation, which had to do with the resident talking to the attending and the attending making a decision, do we proceed or do we not proceed? So immediately we looked at two different things that we could actually target that seemed to be the ones that were going to give us the best bang for our buck, so to speak. Next slide. So as far as opportunities to shorten the second to the most important, the group page to arrival, how to use the... We ask ourselves, how do we utilize the interval more efficiently? Well, one of the things is we involve the anesthesia team. Until then, there had been a real hesitancy on the anesthesia department, who are very good guys, but they were really strapped for resources to be involved in the group paging because they're always involved in the trauma pages, in the STEMI pages, and that page and the other page. And the solution was actually a very simple one, which is we identified a champion in the anesthesia department, and that's Dr. Brad Cardinal, who has been an absolute godsend to us. He is in charge of operations from the anesthesiology teams, and he is absolutely a delight to work with, smart, kind, you know, eager to work. He's a phenomenal partner. And so we started saying, for example, the moment the group page goes on, the anesthesia team moves to the angio suite and they're ready to receive the patient, even if there is no nurses or doctors or, I mean, from the interventional team available yet, they can do monitor anesthesia care immediately, begin the process of intubation. Then we started looking at an expedited transport from table to stretcher, from CT table to the stretcher to the angio table as quickly as we can without stopping, without, you know, with spending a lot of time dilly-dallying. And that next slide created what was the beginning really of a value stream mapping of what can we do to operationalize this. And that led to the blue areas where we began to look at parallel processing. And that really has worked out very well. It worked out very well last night when we were getting this patient, by the way. It's just the last memory I have is just in the middle of the night. And that's what happens is that, next slide, you can get the patient intubated. The anesthesiology team can be on one end of the table intubating the patient while we're gaining access in somewhere else, or at least prepping the patients. So you're not doing in series, but actually in parallel. Dr. Cardinal, next slide, actually created a process, championed in the department, and has the entire system together for the anesthesia teams, which change. And then we were ready with this in mind to begin to look at how could we affect the entire system by having a better group activation, a better parallel process, and how can we influence this? And of course, next slide. Everything that you plan always has a problem. And those of you who follow Murphy's Law will recognize this very well. So next slide. With the go live of the project of May 1st, 2022, we got this letter, and you read the date. It's April 19th. Essentially, what happened was that because of COVID, the factories for contrast agents in China had been shut down for some time, and we were going to go through a period of time with limited or no contrast to be able to carry out the CT angiograms and the CT perfusion studies that we require to qualify the patient for intervention. Let me tell you how bad this was, because people don't realize that during the time that we had the contrast shortage, we got to the point that when we use a balloon for an angioplasty, we would then take, once we were done with that balloon, remove the contrast from the balloon so we could turn around and use it to inject to actually get pictures. That's how tight things got. But that also forced us in this era for us to have a different process. And I'll show you how that is. And what happened is that we had to, during the time of shortage, move from CT qualification, imaging qualification, which takes literally 5 to 10 minutes, to getting the patient from the CT scanner to the MRI and use MRI techniques, which take longer, a little bit more complex, to qualify the patients during that interval. And that's basically what we had to do. We had no choice because we wanted to continue with the process. Next slide. So what we did is we started collecting data on the new process on May 1st, and we collected for a number of months. And then we compared with the baseline population, which is the one we used to look at the problem statement. And they were really not considerably different from the statistical point of view, except one of those groups had more instances of intravenous thrombolysis. And even though slightly significant, it wasn't very much significant. At least I wasn't sure that it made that much of a difference. Next slide. But now in the outcome population, which is the group of the data from 2022, now we had a control process. It met all of the criteria for a control process. But even within this, you can still see that the shaded area, which is the 6 weeks we had no serious amount of contrast, the contrast shortage, the variability is much greater, and it begins to actually get even closer to what we needed to do. So what happened next was a little bit surprising. Next slide is that our primary analysis, which is we want to improve the door to puncture interval, we were not able to prove a statistically significant difference in that. And, you know, I think that you need the you got to go where the data takes you. And that's just the way life is. So we started looking a little bit more granularly. And what became apparent, next slide, is that the interval that we actually targeted, the sub-interval that we actually targeted, we did improve. So clearly, there were some consequences to us targeting sub-intervals that needed to be looked at. The contrast shortage had something to do with it, obviously. The next slide, if you look at the effect of the contract shortage, there was a difference in the spread of the interval in the CT to group paging interval, as it would have been expected. And we think that that's probably in part what changed for us. And I think we need to be cognizant of that. So what do we do with this? Next slide. Well, you have two choices. When your analysis doesn't show what you expect to show, you can be disappointed, or you can realize that maybe there's some things that you did not quite consider, or at least did not consider it as important as you will have to consider them in the future. And in this case, from our point of view, the consideration was the interdependence of the subinterval, that every time you change something, there's bound to be an impact somewhere else. And you got to take that into account in any one of your processes. If you remember, those of you who went through PEMBA, or those who are going to go through PEMBA, one of the aspects that is important on theory of constraints is that once you optimize your capacity constrained resource, don't be surprised if that constraint moves to another part of your workflow. And this is the same thing with this. It's once you optimize one of the subinterval that is interdependent, you got to start looking at the others. And you cannot look at one without measuring the others. Next slide. So our conclusions were that we were right in the sense that the door to puncture interval has several discrete processes that need to be looked at and considered independently, but also that even though they are subject to a granular subinterval analysis that is feasible, prioritizable, more actionable, et cetera, that there is a subinterval interdependence that needs careful interpretation and careful planning, particularly for future projects, and needs parallel monitoring. Where have we gone from here? Next is what have we learned? What additional questions do we have, opportunities? Well, I still am of the opinion personally that the regulatory metrics continue to be inadequate. And I think that it behooves us to actually improve and move everything to Lean Six Sigma, that these metrics require scrutiny, that we cannot just continue to report door to puncture time like it's a homogeneous metric, because it is not. It has different things. And that you can actually challenge these metrics. We have been presenting to the DNV, which is the accrediting agency for our stroke center, every year on the processes that we have. And they have been very eager to listen to the possibility of improving the entire outlook of quality assurance and quality improvement by implementing some of these processes. So what about the impact on other metrics? One of the first questions Don Leiter asked me about when we started this is impact on mortality, quality of life, length of stay, cost of care. And I think that we're still looking and roaming through all of that data. The real problem we face is that most of us still have a day job. And this is where the problem is, that what we have proposed to the hospital and to our institution is to create a dedicated comprehensive stroke center quality improvement team that has multiple people with different skills that can actually implement some of these processes. And my vision would be to have imagined different processes of different depths that are staggered in such a way that when you have, let's say, two or three processes in the define stage, you also have two or three processes in the measure stage, two or three processes in the improvement stage, and you continue to collect the data and so on. Because right now we have data that we have continued to collect, but somebody has to sit, stop what they're doing, and go and analyze the data. Otherwise, we don't have this. Now, we have a new person that is the chair of the Department of Biostatistics, and one of the things that we're looking forward is trying to see if we can interact with them more, because, frankly, I wouldn't say I'm getting too old for this, but I still enjoy it quite a bit. And then the final slide, I'm going to leave you with a final thought. If you give me the next slide. I encourage you guys to, for those of you who know about Lean Six Sigma, to apply it to your processes. Think out of the box. Start dissecting your workflows in the more granular way you can. For those who who do not know about Lean Six Sigma, I would advise you to get certified and involve as many people of your organization as you can. And don't be deterred get involved in analysis paralysis. You really need to start looking at this. Frankly, we have a second Lean Sigma project we just finished. We're now collecting the data. It's been very successful, much more complex than this. It has to do with intravenous thrombolysis. Along the way, we were able to recruit people from the institution here who have Lean Six Sigma expertise and degrees in industrial engineering and all sorts of things. And we're now beginning to look at the data to write the paper to publish, which we'll be happy to share with you. But we could be sitting and publishing papers about the impact of this on multiple fronts on a daily basis. So I'm going to stop here, and if there are any questions, I'll take them. If there are no questions, then I'll be happy to just smile.
Thank you, Camilla, very much. That was an excellent, excellent presentation. As we'll wait for a minute here to see if we get any comments coming into the comment section, but I did have a couple of thoughts as you were going through your slide presentation, and I know your study period was from May of 2022 through December, and as you said, you didn't really get the expected outcome that you anticipated, and it sounds like you've started a new Lean Six Sigma project to look at IVTPA for primary stroke. Have you continued to collect data during 2023 on the door to puncture time, and have you identified any segments that you've made improvements on that have made the overall door to puncture time statistically better?
The short answer is yes. We're still collecting data. We collect data all the time. The real question is stopping to go and analyze it, which is what we need to be doing. What I don't want to do is do it on a haphazard way. What I like to do is create and invest on a system where that can be done over and over again. And the reason we moved to another project is because we were still in the process of analyzing this data, and the hospital administration expressed an interest in helping us with that other project. And therefore, I wanted to strike while the iron was hot, take them all on their word. And it has been a very rewarding experience because it's been a much more complex project. But it also has led to the creation of a live dashboard. So the idea is that the data are being collected at all times, and there's an investment on a system that constantly analyzes the data. So you can go on this Power BI website, and then you can look at as of, you know, March 30th of this year, where are you? And you can do subset analysis. You can export the data and do all of this, and then realize that you can use it for publication or for project generation and so on. So the answer is yes, we have the data. I'm one to invest on a system rather than just doing this and this and the other, and then because that takes too much time and effort, and I think it's like it's not as efficient in my view. So I hope that answered your question.
Do you anticipate when you have resources, and it sounds like you have resources within the organization that you haven't tapped into yet from the Department of Biostatistics, do you anticipate publishing a follow-up to your initial study from the 2022 data?
Correct, especially if we have different outcomes, because it would be very nice for us to come back 3 years later and says, or 2 years later and said, since then, this is what we've done and this is what we've learned. To me, it's all about learning about your own systems and using that knowledge to improve your systems. It's a constant process. One of the things that is different about Lean Six Sigma and all of the other things that are used out there is that it is truly a system of continuous process improvement. It is not a one-time thing. If you do it in a one-time thing, you're lost. And this has been my argument with the accrediting agencies, is that they come for a year, they want to see your last year's data, And, you know, and they, if you go beyond a certain threshold, you pass. Well, how do we know that that threshold really is sufficient? How do we translate that into what is good for our patients? What is optimal for our patients? What is excellence in care? So I think we need to be better than what we do. And rather than just be minimally competent, rather be best of the best, best in class kind of thing. And I think that the numbers is what's going to tell us that, the data.
Yes, thank you for that comment. One of the things when I looked at your analysis as well, and my background is in emergency medicine, and I remember when we were working on optimizing the STEMI treatment, one of the things we realized very early on is if we could have people in the hospital who were competent to provide the TPA in a STEMI case rather than waiting for the cardiologist to come in to administer the TPA, that we saw a significant reduction in door to needle time, obviously. It sounds like within your group page to the patient arriving at the angio suite, there's obviously the need for the team to arrive, right? For the interventionalist to get there and the staff to get there. How, and you mentioned earlier, which I thought was very, very appropriate, was until hospital organizations start running as a 7-day-a-week operation, some of these metrics about length of stay and those kinds of things are not necessarily going to improve because we have to deal with those 2 weekend days where we don't provide the same services on the weekdays. But do you think that in terms of thrombectomies, that having in-house teams is going to be necessary in order for us to really impact the door to puncture time? Or what does your experience and your knowledge tell you about that?
Yeah, I think that in general, the answer to your question is undoubtedly yes. If you're on site, you're in better shape than you're not on site. However, I want to qualify that because there's different aspects here. For example, during on hours, we're all here. Mm-hmm. And during off hours, to some degree, the people who are critical are here. So, for example, I'm on call for stroke and endovascular this week. So this weekend, I'll be here most of the weekend. So it's not like I'm anywhere else. So that's mm-hmm. one comment. The anesthesia team lives in-house. So one of the reasons why we wanted to involve them so early is because they can expedite, because they can receive the patient directly. The emergency department go one flight up to our angio suite, and then the anesthesia team can start the process of intubating, getting the patient prepped, and so on. Now, the city of Columbia, everyone lives here within minutes. I mean, I can drive from my house in here in 10 minutes. So it's not a big drive anywhere because, you know, we live in the middle of nowhere, sort of. So, you know, it's just a rural area. But I think, for example, the interventional team does not sleep in-house. Now, this is a problem that I have to be careful how I address it because I don't know who's listening or who will be listening. And I do want to keep my job. So I want to be sure that I don't get, you know, that the result of this podcast is not a pink slip on my desk on Monday, you know? So, but I think in general, at least here in the institution and university, we have a considerable problem with recruitment and retention. It has to do with salaries, compensation, the market demands, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that somewhere in the organization, somebody needs to really take a serious look at the problem of this is not a cost problem. It's an investment problem. And this is the part that doesn't really sink in very well. And where we have problems is that if we don't invest in some of these folks that are critical, you know, we're going to have problems. In Loyola, which is the university that I was before I came here, we had a sleeping team in house, but that team covered both STEMI and stroke and all intervention. So a hybrid team like that may be a solution. One of the things we did very well in Loyola is we created an entire endovascular center that included the cardiologists, ourselves, the vascular surgeons, and the interventional radiologists. So what happens is for every dollar you spend in a comprehensive center like that, you get more for your money because you have more population being served. The same rooms are used for different purposes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Inventory becomes much easier. I mean, how many times do I have to go on a week to the cardiac catheterization laboratory to borrow, quote unquote, or, you know, transpose balloons and wires and things that I use for some certain interventions? So I think that, but it's a conversation that we should have. Mm-hmm. One of the problems that I learned in Pemba, for example, that I still live by that, is that I think that one of the biggest problems that our institutions, all universities that I've ever worked with and all hospitals I work with, continue to work on cost accounting when they should be working on throughput accounting. It's a much more facile way of doing things, much more realistic, and it gives you a better feel. And I wish we could make that transition, but it's hard mm-hmm. to do.
Yeah, it is very challenging, very challenging. This podcast is sponsored by the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville's Haslam College of Business. In less than one calendar year, this program will equip you with valuable business acumen and leadership development not found in traditional medical school curriculum. Are you ready to join the longest-running physician-only MBA program in the country and a network of nearly 1,000 Pemba graduates? Visit tiny.utk.edu/podpodcast for information about this exciting opportunity. And now we'll return to the episode. Well, I appreciate your comments very much, Camillo. This was fantastic. One of the things I didn't realize going into our discussion today was that you yourself have invested in becoming a Lean Six Sigma black belt. Could you talk to me a little bit about that decision and whether that was something that was paid for by your organization at the time? How much time did it take and what was the cost of you achieving that level of certification?
It's not very costly, and I paid it out of my own pocket. I did it not too long ago, actually, when I started looking into trying to introduce the process over here. You know, and it was easy when you're more senior. It's easier because what happens is that you already have the experience and the expertise. So the information is information you've handled before. So there's, you know, it's what you come together is how to put it all together in. It's like baking a cake. You know how to make the meringue, you know how to make the filling, you know how to make the dough. So all of a sudden, you know how to put it all together, turn the oven and make the cake. And that's basically what I got out of it. And I did it. So when I speak, I had a little bit more, quote, authority, if you will, that I've gone through the process. I know what it means. Now, I also had there's a certain selfishness to everything we do. This project with this publication, I like to actually submit it to the council where I got my certificate to become not only black belt, but master black belt. You have to have had a project that you have conducted and finished that you submitted and it gets rated, et cetera, et cetera. So I suspect that this may actually help me.
Well, thank you very much. We've pretty much reached the end of our time, but this has been a great conversation and discussion. I very much appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to join us on the show.
Thank you so much for having me, and look forward to talking some more anytime. Okay?
Absolutely. Stay in touch. Thanks again.
Good to see you. Godspeed.
That wraps up our show for today. Thank you very much for joining and listening to the podcast. If you have any comments or questions regarding this episode, please feel free to add them in the comment section on our website, tiny.utk.edu/podpodcast. We love hearing from you and are happy to answer any questions you may have. I will add a link to the website below. Please also don't forget to subscribe to the podcast by clicking the subscribe button. Add Pemba On Demand to your podcast library today. I would also appreciate it if you could leave a review of the podcast on your podcast player. Share the podcast with your friends and colleagues also. Please take good care of yourselves, and as always, Good luck with your future.